An old guy on a moped pulled up at a stoplight next to a brand new convertible Lamborghini. He says to the woman behind the wheel, "What kind of a car is that?" She says, "It's a Lamborghini." He says, "Well, how fast will it go?" She says, "Up to 190 miles per hour." He says, "How much did you pay for that thing?" She says, $322,000. Amazing. He says, "Do you mind if I take a look? Be my guest," she says. So still sitting on his moped, he leans over the passenger side door and takes a gander at all the technology on the dashboard. "This is incredible," he says. And just then the light changed and the woman behind the wheel decided, "I'm going to show this old dude what this Lamborghini can do." And so she hit the gas from 0 to 60 in 2.9 seconds, leaving the old guy in her dust, or so she thought. But when she looks in her rearview mirror, lo and behold, here comes the old guy on his moped, closing fast, and he whooshes right past her. Well, she is not going to lose this race, so she gives it even more gas, all the way up to 120 miles per hour. She whooshes past him, looks in the rearview mirror, and wouldn't you know it, here he comes again, whooshing past her. So this time she puts the pedal to the metal, 190 miles an hour. She whooshes past him. And sure enough, here he comes again, except this time, instead of whooshing past her, he crashes into the back of the Lamborghini. She hits the brakes, jumps out of her vehicle, rushes back to where the old guy is lying next to the road, badly wounded. She says, "I'm so sorry. Is there anything I can help you with?" "Yes," he says. "Would you please unhook my suspenders from the side view mirror?" Oh, that explains. Life is a lot like that story. Life has a way of dragging us where we don't want to go, jerking us this way, jerking us that way. And if we needed any reminder of that, you may not have noticed, but there was an election last Tuesday. The last couple months of the election campaign felt a lot like that story. Ups, downs, lead changes, twists and turns, all of it ending last Tuesday in a way that to many of us felt like a thud. Here at Life Journey Church, we're not monolithic. We don't all think alike. And by the way, that's a good thing. That's part of the beauty of this church. It's also part of the frustration of this church. But hey, heaven is going to be a diverse place, so we may as well start getting used to it now. Some of us may have awakened on the morning after on Wednesday and felt like the driver of that Lamborghini. Yes, we won the race. But many others of us, awakened on the morning after and found ourselves feeling more like the old guy on the moped laying beside the road, badly injured. And we may come here this morning needing some words of comfort and wisdom and insight. If our faith is going to be real, if our faith is going to be relevant, it's important that we be able to apply our faith to all aspects of our life, even our political experiences. But it's difficult, it's tricky, it's sensitive to talk about political subjects. But I don't want us to be unreal and detach our faith from what is relevant. So this morning I'm going to take the risk of trying to speak carefully, thoughtfully, and in a nonpartisan way about what this last week felt like to many of us. In the process, I might end up saying something stupid. If I do so, it won't be the first time, nor will it probably be the last time. So I ask for your grace. But let's try to talk about what is relevant. If I'm going to be transparent with you, I have to say that when I awakened this past Wednesday morning, I felt a deep physical heaviness that almost felt like a death. It hit me hard, harder than I thought it would, as it did many of you. Raising the question, as people of faith, how should we respond to bitter defeat in life? But this is a question that sweeps much broader than the political, because God knows every single one of our lives, in our personal lives, time and time again, we will experience bitter personal defeats. The loss of a job, financial insolvency, a devastating health diagnosis, a divorce, an adult child who refuses to talk to us, the death of a loved one, the death of a dream, a seesaw battle with addictions, up, down, a deep moral failure. I can't believe I did that. Life is riddled with deep personal defeats. 40% of all marriages fail. 75% of all new businesses fail. 81% of all new hires fail. 88% of all New Year's resolutions fail. And 100% of all human bodies eventually fail. All of which means if we're going to succeed in life, we won't succeed in life unless and until we get good at failing well. This morning, we're launching a new sermon series called Seven Biblical Promises That Anchor Our Sanity and Support Our Serenity. Today, we're going to focus on the first of those seven promises, which may be the most important promise that anchors it all, because this first promise that we're going to explore today goes directly to the question, as followers of Jesus, how should we respond to bitter defeat? Let's start with a prayer. God, many of us are here today with a sense of despair and sadness. For some of us, it's personal. For some of us, it's political. But for all of us, we need to understand, as followers of Jesus, how we're supposed to react, how we're supposed to respond. So speak to us some words of encouragement, insight, and guidance from your holy word, we ask in the name of Jesus. Amen. Before we dive into today's scripture text, first, let's make sure we understand the context for the text. There's a backstory here that we need to understand to put the text in its proper perspective. You see, Jesus' disciples came to believe, came to be convinced that he was the long-awaited Messiah who was destined to liberate their nation from the occupying Roman forces. Jesus, for his part, repeatedly tried to communicate to his disciples that his calling to be the Messiah was much more complicated and nuanced than simply being a political deliverer. But that seems to have not been able to penetrate the consciousness of Jesus' followers, because from the time they were knee-high to a grasshopper, their parents and their spiritual teachers had been pounding it into them that the primary role of the Messiah would be to be a political deliverer for their nation. And that belief was so deeply ingrained that even after Jesus died, His disciples were saying things like Luke 24:21, we had hoped that Jesus was the one to redeem Israel. In other words, they were hoping that Jesus was the one who was going to save their nation. And for a long time, it looked to them like that's precisely what was happening as Jesus healed people, as Jesus fed people. Many in Israel found themselves saying, maybe this is the one that we've long been waiting for. Throngs of people began to follow Jesus. It built and it built until in that third year of his public ministry, when he entered the city of Jerusalem for the festival of the Passovers, throngs of people lined the roadway, waving palm branches in the air and shouting things like, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Note that word, the King. These people were excited that Jesus, their political deliverer, was finally there to throw off the Roman yoke. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. And the spirit of Jesus' closest disciples must have soared because it seemed as if their dream was coming true. But then, a sudden and unexpected plot twist. Judas Iscariot, one of Jesus' disciples, conspired with the institutional religious leaders to go to the occupying Romans and convince them that this Jesus represented a threat to their occupation. He was arrested. He was put on trial. At his public trial, hordes of people showed up. A throng of people, but not the same throng that had showed up to line the roads. No, this was a different group of people. These were the people in Jesus' nation who feared that Jesus was going too far, that he was going to force the hands of the Romans, and they were going to come down hard on their nation. And so this Jesus had to be stopped. And so at his trial, this throng of people began to chant in unison, away with him, crucify him, quote, we have no king but Caesar, close quote. And they crucified him. They nailed him to the cross, leaving his disciples stunned, dismayed. How could this happen? How could so many of their fellow countrymen have made such a devastating decision? Jesus had healed them. Jesus had fed them. Jesus was the hope of the nation. How could they turn on him? But they did, and now he was dead. And for Jesus' disciples, they hadn't just lost their beloved Jesus. Their dream for their nation was also dead. So they wake up the morning after and they feel this deep physical heaviness because someone had died and with it their dream. Are you seeing the parallels? For those who this past week may have had a sense of political despair, but remember, it sweeps broader than that. Anybody here today who's facing a bitter personal defeat, whatever the nature, loss of a career, loss of a relationship, loss of your health, for anybody here who's facing a bitter disappointment, do you see the parallels? Sure, there are factual differences between what we're experiencing, what Jesus' disciples experienced, but the scriptures speak relevantly to all of our situations in life. If you're experiencing a personal bitter defeat in your life right now, do you see the parallels? The death of a dream. The destruction of expectations. Raising the question, as followers of Jesus, how are we supposed to respond to bitter defeat? All of which brings us to today's scripture. text. On the third morning after Jesus' death, as the Sabbath-based restrictions on activity lifted, several of Jesus' closest disciples, several of the women who were in his inner circle, made their way to the tomb where Jesus was buried. We understand the force, the magnetic force that drew them to that place, because when a loved one dies, we find ourselves wanting to be near what is left of them. And so we go to the graveside, or we go to the urn that has their ashes. We just need to be near their earthly remains. This is what drew the women to the tomb. They were there to mourn their loss. But when they arrive at the tomb, another unexpected twist. Two angels in dazzling white clothes appear to them. And the angels say to them, in the words of Luke 24:5, "Why do you seek the living among the dead? He's not here. He is risen." And then Matthew's gospel goes on. The angels there go on to say, "He is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him." So that it turns out, the very thing that Jesus' disciples thought marked the end, Jesus' death, was merely a passageway meant to lead them to a new beginning, greater than they could ever imagine. But don't miss the significance of the specific words used here, each phrase inspired with wisdom that can help guide us when we're facing bitter defeat in our life. Note where the angels began by saying, "Why do you seek the living among the dead?" Whenever we experience a great loss, we have a tendency to get stuck there. We just want to sit by the tomb and mourn our loss. And that's where Jesus' female disciples were. And it's very understandable, because when we experience a great loss, we have to grieve it. It's only healthy to grieve it. It's necessary that we grieve it. But it's so important that we don't get stuck there. Because there is no life in the graveyard. Why do you seek the living among the dead? Why are you seeking life here in this place? Because this isn't where you'll find it. He, Jesus, the angels say, "He is not here." Well, if he's not here, then where is he? They tell us, the angels tell us, "He is risen and he is going ahead of you into Galilee." So here were these disciples, lost in deep grief, right there at graveside, lost in their grief, trying to be close to Jesus, trying to figure out how to move forward. And the angel is saying to them, "Jesus isn't here. He's already gone ahead of you and is calling you into what's next. He's calling you into the future. Because if you can manage to push through your grief and by faith go to him, go to what is next, guess what? There you will see him. There you will find him. There you will find resurrection power. There you will find life. If only you push forward, push through it, and dare to believe that Jesus is out there ahead of you. Because you see, for followers of Jesus, no death is ever final. For we who are people of the cross, no defeat is ever final. And that's the promise, the first, perhaps the greatest promise, that when internalized can anchor our sanity and support our serenity. It's what Jesus said at Lazarus' tomb before he raised Lazarus from the dead. John 11:25, I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, though they die, yet they shall live. Do you see what that does and does not say? There is no promise here that we as followers of Jesus won't have to experience death and defeat, bitter defeat in this life. The promise is not that we won't experience defeat. The promise is that though we die, though we experience defeat, yet we shall live. Those who die in Christ rise with him. Those who lose themselves in Jesus rise with him. That is the promise. One of my lesbian friends once said to me, when I die and they put me in the ground, I want to be buried with my four-wheel drive pickup truck. I said, why? She said, because I ain't never seen a hole it couldn't get me out of. Okay, I don't really have a lesbian friend who said that. But I do have lots of lesbian friends who are very attached to their four-wheel drive pickup truck who might say that. Jesus is like that four-wheel drive. There is no hole you can fall into that he can't get you out of. Because Jesus ain't dead. He is alive. He's out in front of you. And he's saying, come on. Come on to what's next. Dare to believe that with me you can rise from this bitter defeat. Claim the promise. Claim the presence. Peggy Key of Portage, Michigan, tells how one Easter Sunday morning she was driving to church and she decided to tell her little kids the Easter story. And then she said to her kids, so this is the day where we celebrate Jesus coming back to life. Without skipping a beat, her 5-year-old son Kevin said, will he be at church today? I don't know what her answer was, but the correct answer would be yes. Yes. The risen Christ is right here in this place today. Can you sense it? Can you feel it? In this very room, the risen Christ is looking us in the eye, looking those of us in the eye who have experienced deep despair and sadness, whether personal or political. He's looking us in the eye and he's saying, did you not learn anything from my death and my resurrection? For those who follow me, no defeat is ever final. Even death itself is not the end. Death for a follower of Jesus is not even the beginning of the end. It's just the end of the beginning. Because for followers of Jesus, death never gets the last word unless we let it. For followers of Jesus, for people of the cross who understand and have internalized this fundamental story and pattern of the life of Jesus, no defeat is ever final unless we say so. So why would you say so? Claim the power and the presence of the risen Christ in and around you. Yes. Grieve. Grieve your loss. Mourn your loss. But don't get stuck there. Get up. Dust yourself off. and try again. Most of you know the name John Grisham. He's one of the most successful novelists ever. 300 million copies of his books in print in 31 different languages. But there's a backstory there too. It wasn't always that way. When John Grisham wrote his first novel, A Time to Kill, he took his precious manuscript and he presented it to an agent. The agent read it, consulted with a publisher, came back to him and said, "No thanks, it's not good enough." Then a second time he submitted the manuscript to a different agent, different publishing company. Same answer, not good enough. A third time, same thing. Each time he kept making himself vulnerable, which is hard to do, presenting his precious manuscript. 28 different times he was told, "No, it's not good enough." Imagine how he felt the first time he got a no. Imagine what he felt like the 10th time he got a no. Imagine what he felt like the 28th time he heard, "No, it's not good enough." But on the 29th time, he talked to an agent who connected to a publisher who agreed to do a 5,000 print run. He, Grisham, ended up purchasing 1,000 of the 5,000 books, putting them in the trunk of his vehicle, and driving around to local bookstores, hawking them himself. His first book did okay enough that the publisher was willing to do a small print run of his second book, The Firm. That book took off and became a New York Times bestseller, which in turn bootstrapped his first book into best-selling status. And John Grisham has never since looked back. 37 straight New York Times best-selling books. Because intuitively, he understood that no defeat is ever final unless I say so. What if he'd said so? What if after the first time, the 10th time, or the 28th time, what if he had said, "I can't take this anymore, I quit"? But he didn't, and it made all of the difference. This is the promise, this is the principle that we're talking about today. For followers of Jesus, no defeat is ever final unless you say so. Have you internalized that principle? Do you believe it? Are you living it? Because faith without works is dead. Live your faith. And while we're at it, here's something else that's really important to remember. Because what we're talking about today, this promise, it's not just about grieve your loss, get up, dust yourself off, and try again. Because you see, it's also critically important to recognize that every bitter defeat we experience presents the opportunity for us to learn something important that can make us better if we're humble enough to listen and to learn. Jonas Salk tried and failed 200 times to develop an effective polio vaccine before he finally found the right combination. Once he was asked, "How did it feel to fail 200 times?" His response was, "I never failed 200 times. I simply discovered 200 ways not to make a polio vaccine." Because you see, he intuitively recognized that every defeat was an opportunity to learn, that he could build on that learning, and each step of the way would get him closer and closer to his ultimate goal. It's the same way with us. You see, progress doesn't happen simply, easily. Progress is not a linear, straight, upward line. One bitter cold day, Linda decided she was going to visit her best friend, Alice. To get there, she had to walk a quarter mile in the bitter cold. When she finally arrived, she said to her friend, Alice, "Whew, I didn't think I was going to get here," she says. For every step forward I took, the ice was so bad I slid two steps back. Her friend Alice pointed out that if that was literally true, one step forward, two steps sliding back, she never would have gotten there. Linda said, "I know," she said. In fact, she said, "At one point, I said, forget this," and I turned around to go home, and that's how I got here. One step forward, two steps back. Progress in life is not linear. It's a zigzag process of success and setbacks, trial and error, as we learn and grow as we go. Are you able, are you humble enough to learn and grow from your defeats, to listen to God, to listen to the people around you, to listen to the voice of the Spirit in you, to listen to your harshest critic? If you are a football fan, you know the name Ndamukong Suh. He's a star defensive tackle in the NFL. He began his career, I believe, with the Detroit Lions. And several years later, when he became free agent, he signed with the Miami Dolphins, the then largest contract any defensive professional football player had ever signed. But his next 3 years with the Dolphins were tragic. He was full of himself. He was bombastic. He would say whatever he wanted. He was confrontational. And in the process, he became toxic to the point that 3 years into this, the Dolphins decided to cut their losses. And they didn't even trade him. They waived him, the lowest of the low, for a professional player, especially someone who had been a star. He got waived. Bitter defeat. In between there and signing on again with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Ndamukong Suh says, "I had to do a lot of soul searching. I had to look deep inside myself." He said, "I had to admit to myself that I, quote, had zero tact. I had to admit to myself that if you're not careful about how you do things, you end up being the bad guy." And then he went on to make this insightful observation. He said, "For a long time in my career, I was always just saying what I wanted to say, never thinking about how I delivered the message. I was just making my opinion known, regardless of how it impacted others. And as a result, I was creating divisions on my team and pushing people away, and it was putting me in a negative headspace." So he says, when he landed next at Tampa Bay, Suh says, "I started listening way more than I talked. I paid attention to how I interacted with people. I observed others' reactions and adjusted as needed, and I chose my words carefully to be more empathetic. I learned, don't just think about what you want, think about what others want." And he went on to reach all new heights. That advice is worth its weight in gold for every one of us, whether we're experiencing a bitter personal defeat or a bitter political defeat. I heard a Democratic strategist on TV this week say something like, he said, "This is a time for humility and for exploration, not for finger pointing. If I want to be a more effective advocate for social justice and for political progress, what can I learn from bitter political defeats? One of the important things we have to learn is to listen to those who don't think like us." Remember what Jesus said. Jesus said, "Love your enemies." That, whether you're on the left or on the right, that statement applies to your political opponents. Love your enemies. Jesus did not say that out of some gauzy, fuzzy, naive idealism. He said that because he wanted to make us, his followers, more effective change agents. Someone once said, loving and listening are so close together that when you listen to someone, they feel loved. Nobody was ever persuaded by condemnation or name-calling. People are persuaded when we take the time to get to know them, when we listen to them, when we build community, when we build trust, when we hear what's going on with them. Then maybe we're in a position to speak in a way that can persuade them. And this is true not just of political persuasion. This is true of our personal defeats. Am I able to listen to my personal enemies? Because as followers of Jesus, we are called to love. Because Jesus understood the power of love to create positive change. So, for followers of Jesus, no defeat is ever final unless you say so. Also, remember, every defeat is an opportunity to learn. So when you experience defeat, be sure to reflect, listen, learn, and grow. No defeat is final unless you say so or refuse to learn from your experience. And while we're at it, one last thing as we begin to wind down. When we experience bitter personal defeat, it hurts. And that emotional pain causes us to want to curl up in a ball and withdraw and give up. We don't want our heart to be broken again. And so we want to withdraw. We want to disassociate. We want to turn inward. When you feel that way, remember the words of Bette Midler. It's the heart afraid of breaking that never learns to dance. It's the dream afraid of waking that never takes the chance. It's the one who won't be taken who cannot seem to give, and the soul afraid of dying that never learns to live. In a popular TED Talk, psychologist Susan David talks about how critically important it is that we not allow disappointment to cause us to retreat and withdraw in life. She says that how we respond to disappointment in our life affects everything. It affects our activities, our career path, our relationships. It can even affect our health. Susan David says, we must be willing to, quote, deal with the world as it is, not as we wish it to be. And then she goes on to say this. She says, I've had hundreds of people tell me what they don't want to feel. They say things like, I don't want to try again because I don't want to feel disappointed again. Or, I just want this feeling to go away. When she hears that, this is what she says to them. She says, you have dead people's goals. She says, the only dead people never get stressed, never get broken hearts, never experience the disappointment that comes with failure. Tough emotions are part of our contract with life. You don't get to have a meaningful career or raise a family or leave the world a better place without stress and discomfort. Discomfort is the price of admission to a meaningful life. A lot of wisdom in that. Frederick Douglass, for his part, once said, where there is no struggle, there is no progress. Pain is part of the price of progress. Resist that urge to withdraw. In Jesus' time, in Jesus' culture, in Jesus' nation, while they were under Roman occupation, there were many different forms of political response. Different people who took different approaches to how to deal with the occupying Roman forces. In Jesus' inner circle, you will find people of the right and of the left in terms of ancient political differences. But there was another form of political response to the Roman occupation that is not represented in the inner circle of Jesus. Those people were referred to as Essenes, E-S-S-E-N-E-S, Essenes. And their approach to the Roman occupation was to withdraw into the desert and to establish tiny little communes, communities in the desert, disconnected and far away from civilization. Their answer to the problem was retreat and withdraw. There's a reason why there are no Essenes in the inner circle of Jesus' original followers. That's because withdrawing is the antithesis of what Jesus calls us to do. Jesus calls us to engage the world as it is, boldly, knowing what we're up against, knowing that the part of the pain, a part of the cost of progress is pain. Never yield to the urge to withdraw and disassociate. Pain is the price of progress. And if you don't believe me, if you're experiencing deep despair from the recent election, let Grandpa Jeff tell you a story. Because I'm old enough to remember the 2004 election campaign, Bush v. Kerry. Some of you are old enough to remember that campaign. George W. Bush was seeking re-election. You are old enough, Amy, don't give me that. George W. Bush was seeking re-election. And it was nip and tuck. So he decided to use some culture war issues to drive a wedge. He adopted a very strong anti-gay platform. Under Clinton, there had been some marginal progress toward gay rights. But now Bush was running in opposition to that, and that was enough to swing several swing states in his favor, and he won. I remember 2004, and I remember how many folks in this congregation felt utter despair. And if you had said back then that within 11 years of that election, the United States Supreme Court would recognize a national constitutional right to marriage equality for gay people, if you had told us that in 2004, we would have said, what you've been smoking? We would have said, unbelievable. And yet it happened. Two steps forward, one step back. One step forward, two steps back. The battle is not to the faint of heart. It's not to those who withdraw. The battle is to those who hang in there and pay the price. What if people had given up in 2004? Think about how many more people in the world today would be struggling and suffering. Thank God for those who said, no defeat is ever final unless we say so. There are people that need you, who are counting on you, both in your personal life and as a social justice advocate. There are people who are counting on you not to withdraw, not to give up. Let me close with this. David Sharp was a senior airman in the United States Air Force. He was stationed in Uzbekistan for a period of time. In 2002, he was sent back to the States after his deployment, and he came back filled with residual trauma. In Uzbekistan, he had seen two of his buddies slaughtered, and that haunted him. He said, when I got back to the States, I was drinking way too much, and I was getting in all kinds of fights. Until he said, one day, one of my buddies pulled me aside and said, David, you need something positive in your life. I think you need a companion dog. And so his friend drug him to the local shelter, David looks around, sees all of these desperate dogs. He happens to notice a little pit bull sitting in the corner, looking up at him with big eyes as if to say, please, please, choose me. He picked her up, he held her, and never put her down. He took her home, he named her Cheyenne. And for a while, this really made a difference for him, having somebody else in his life, someone to love, someone to be with. But then two of his buddies stateside committed suicide. And that sent David back into a deep spiral. Until one day he says, I went to my room and I picked up a handgun that my parents had given me years earlier. I pulled back the hammer. I put my finger on the trigger. I put the barrel in my mouth. And just then he said, Cheyenne, just 6 months old, a puppy at the time, Cheyenne came over to me and licked my ear. And that distracted me enough that I took the barrel of the gun out of my mouth, looked at her and said, what'd you do that for? Whereupon he says, she crawled into my lap, swirled, and laid down her head resting on my right thigh. I sat there, he said, with her head resting on my right thigh and the handgun resting on my left thigh. And when she looked up at me with those big eyes, he said, I understood what she was trying to say to me. She was saying to me, you have to make a choice. You can choose to take your life, or you can choose me. I need you. He says, I chose her, and I've never looked back. And it sure is a good thing, because he went on to create a nonprofit called Pets for Vets. And he's connected hundreds of traumatized veterans with hundreds of traumatized abandoned dogs. And both have found life through that process. What if he had given up? By the way, this is a picture of Cheyenne as a full-grown dog. It sure is a good thing he didn't give up. How about us? We are followers of Jesus. As followers of Jesus, we know the story of the cross. We get the death and the resurrection of Jesus. We know that no death is ever final. No defeat is ever final unless we say so. That means we have a choice. Make your choice.